This is a case where essentially the trial judge thought she was doing the right thing, but the state of the record, unfortunately, fails to justify her actions. And that action was a dismissal on speedy trial grounds. Just shortly as a way of background, the defendant was charged with interfering with a peace officer and possession of hydrocodone. She was arrested in May of 2012 and immediately made bail. Flash forward to February of 2014, she files a motion to dismiss for lack of a speedy trial, and the trial court granted that motion the following May. First of all, we mentioned this in our brief, but a word about the hearing. There's no real evidence. It was essentially a conversation, and unfortunately, for purposes of the record, a kind of confusing conversation. And we think that this underlies what is essentially a mistake on the part of the trial judge, that without any definite facts, the Barker versus Wingo balancing test is pretty much difficult, if not impossible. And I'll emphasize that, as this court knows, the facts are reviewed with deference to the trial court, but the actual balancing of the Barker versus Wingo factors is considered de novo on appellate review.
The motion to dismiss set for that day, actually set?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, I think y'all appeared for that hearing on the motion to suppress. And so my question is, was the motion to dismiss actually set for a hearing for that day?
That's something else that wasn't clear to me. And I think since Mr. Davis was there, you could probably answer it more carefully, but it did seem, and this is way outside the record, but based on my understanding, it seems that the prosecutors were a little surprised at what happened. But at any rate, it turned into a hearing on her motion to dismiss for lack of a speedy trial. So basically, I mean, what I'd like to do today is just simply go, I mean, it's a simple, confusing, yes, but a simple speedy trial case, and so I'm just going to go through the Barker versus Wingo factors as much as I can, given the kind of confusing state of the record. The one thing that's clear is the length of the delay, and I think we all agree it was about 2 years, which for a misdemeanor is long, but it's not really a factor so much as merely it triggers an examination of the other factors. So we concede that is long enough to justify examination of the other factors. Which brings us to, why did the delay happen? What are the reasons? And the best way to look at this is to simply sort of go through the list of all the different postponements that were experienced.
Let me ask you a question. I didn't see any cases right on point. And, you know, the purpose of the Speedy Trial Act is to make sure that the government doesn't just drag these matters out and unduly delay an accused's right to have their day in court. Did you see any cases out there? Because I didn't, in your argument, I didn't glean that you were citing to any, where it was not the prosecution arm of the government that was causing the problem, but actually the court side of the government that was causing the problem. Understanding the court is a neutral tribunal, but nevertheless, an arm of the government. And so that was where I was, because it's clear to me that the trial court fell on her sword and took the blame. But, and so my question really is, can the court be also part of the problem? Maybe unfair to the prosecutor's office if they are, but can they be part of the problem as well?
Certainly, and that goes to how we're going to balance these factors. I mean, to take one extreme side, if we were deliberately delaying the trial to gain some sort of tactical advantage, and that could be shown in court, then not only is that going to weigh heavily against the state, it's probably going to wipe out all the other factors. Whereas the other side of the continuum, if the trial judge is dilatory, then, like you say, it's an arm of the government. And somebody's got to bear the blame, and it's not going to be the defendant.
Right.
It's going to be the state, but only very slightly, would be our view. And in this case...
So it goes to the weight of the factors, is
yes,
what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes,
and what would that fall under? That's the reasons?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And here we have just like you're saying.
Excuse me for interrupting.
Sure.
So if that's part of the reasons, then do you look at the state's efforts to get the thing to trial, or is that not part of the computation?
It's not part of the calculation that at least I can see.
Because I know you look at whether the defendant asked for a trial or just asked for dismissal.
That's right.
Do you look at whether the state tried to push it?
Sure. I mean, it's almost you're getting to an idea of, like, is the state asserting its right to a trial, I suppose, and which is an interesting way to look at it. I think that what that would do is probably would attenuate whatever slight balancing against the state that dilatory practice by the trial judge would have. And I don't mean that this particular trial judge is dilatory, but in general. I think if the state was begging for a trial, then I think that would probably make that factor weigh less heavily against the state. But that's, unfortunately, I can't make that argument in this case, so it's sort of academic. But in this case, we have essentially a situation where, and I'll try not to go into too much detail about it, but she was arrested in May 2012. In July, trial judge has a continuance.
Steve died at some part in that point.
Steve Swander died in between then, I think. And
first and the second. I put it on a timeline.
Okay. And then in between that, and then, the trial judge again on her own had a continuance in January of 2013, so several months later. Then in April, there was another continuance by the court, this time because the coordinator or the judge thought that Mr. Davis didn't have enough notice of the suppression hearing, which I probably was a mistake, but again, it's sort of unclear from the record. In May and June of 2013, the defendant asked for a couple of continuances. Then we have July, it's a trial judge again. Then in September, a kind of confusing thing where Mr. Davis was in a trial somewhere else, but possibly the state might not have had witnesses ready, but it's not particularly clear because there seemed to be some contradiction on that during the hearing. But at any rate, it seems like that's kind of a trade-off, that they both were having trouble getting everything together at that time. Then the state clearly asked for continuance the following January. That was 2014. And then in April, the trial judge does another continuance, and it was in May that she files her motion to dismiss. So by my count, it looks like about five postponements because of the trial judge, two clearly because of the defendant alone, one maybe shared between the state and the defendant, and one where just the state was asking for a continuance. So it's hard to calculate, but maybe 6 months of continuances or attributable to the defendant if you count the time that her lawyer was in trial. So it's mostly the fault of the trial judge, just like you were asking, Judge. So that's going to weigh slightly against the state, except that the defendant apparently acquiesced in all of these trial court continuances. So as the defendant argues now, she was trying to set these suppression hearings, but it's not like there was any active objection to, hey, why do you keep postponing this trial? And I should point out that the one thing in the record that was very, very clear was that the judge bent over backward trying to make it clear that the prosecutors, at least, were not at fault at all. She really was.
In fact, do you think that the written waiver of right to speedy trial that was signed by the defendant and his counsel in the resets plays in this?
I think it plays a role. It is sort of boilerplate, I'll admit that, but what it says to me is that she and her attorney are faced with this thing that they're signing, and it has all that stuff on the bottom, and it seems at the very least that it may not be an active, you know, according to Hoyle, waiver of her Sixth Amendment rights, but at least everybody there kind of has fair notice that, look, you're requesting this. Obviously, you're sort of acquiescing in this thing being sort of kicked down the field a bit and put on the back burner. I think it goes to clearly, the defendant and her lawyer knew what they were doing, and it goes to the next thing I'm going to talk about is whether she was active in asserting her right to a trial. And which brings me to this. I think that, like I said, she's claiming that, the defendant's claiming that she's always been willing and able to litigate this suppression issue, which might be true, but only occasionally. Obviously, that wasn't true during those periods that that she was actually requesting continuances. But in spite of these postponements, some of which she requested, and none that she took issue with, by the way, she still files a motion to dismiss for lack of a speedy trial. And to our mind, it's a quintessential example of a person who really wants a dismissal. They don't really want the trial. When it finally came down to it, it was almost like she sat up and said, well, it's been 2 years. I want this thing dismissed. And that's why, given the very strange factual situation of how this played out, that as far as the factor of her asserting her right, I think that comes out, I think that should be weighed against her. Finally, prejudice. A defendant who wants to dismiss for lack of a speedy trial has to show prejudice. And there's zero evidence at all because of, again, the peculiar way that this was handled. I mean, obviously she didn't testify, so there's no specific evidence of prejudice. It seems that her only argument now kind of about prejudice has to do with the merits of the case. And I'm not very clear about how that works, but the point is that there's nothing, excuse me, in the record about loss of witnesses, anxiousness. As far as I can tell, she was never in jail during this period. The lack of any kind of evidence about prejudice at all, that's not an excuse to sort of speculate about whether or not she would have been hurt or whether or not she was hurt by any of these delays. Finally, like I said before,
what did she say in her motion to dismiss?
I can't remember.
Because there's got to be a ground like. The delay has caused...
I do remember a generalized statement of that she has been prejudiced, but I don't remember specifically how she phrased it. But in the end, when we balance these factors, and again, this court has to resolve them sort of de novo, the delay was attributable mostly to the trial court, which would normally weigh slightly against the state. But here, again, the defendant acquiesced in some of the delay, so at best, that's a wash. Now, the defendant's assertion of her right to a speedy trial was tenuous at best. The first time she brought up a speedy trial was when she asked for a dismissal. So that should count heavily against her. Finally, she makes zero showing of prejudice. That should also count heavily against her. So on balance, she did not show that she was denied her right to a speedy trial, and she certainly didn't show that she was entitled to a dismissal on that basis. Therefore, the state prays that this case be remanded to the trial judge.
When we write, we're supposed to provide guidance for the bar and also for the bench. So think about that when you're listening to my question. I know you're expecting an off-the-wall question because you always get them. But in a civil case, there is a plaintiff and there is a defendant. And the trial judge waits for them to set the case. The trial judge isn't out setting the case usually. And if nobody sets it, the trial judge puts them on the dismissal docket. So everybody knows where the burden to get something tried lies. On the criminal side, nobody sets anything. The coordinator has instructions to stick things on the docket every 6 weeks. The trial judge doesn't really do it. The state doesn't set anything. The defendant doesn't set anything. So who has the obligation to keep things moving? Because that's one of the problems we're facing in the judiciary now. That is, the legislature has this idea that we're supposed to keep things moving. So in a criminal case, whose obligation is that? And who should bear the burden of keeping things moving? Is it the state, the defense, or the trial judge?
Well, there are several ways to answer that. I think one way is to say that the nature of the criminal case and the panoply of constitutional rights that the defendant's going to have makes it fundamentally different, because you can't, in a criminal case, you can't have a sort of a DWOP situation, because the state
What you've got is a DWOP.
Only because it's not sort of self-actuating. It has to exist because of the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights. And she has the burden to go to the court and prove that my rights have been violated, not just because, you know, the computer program tells the coordinator that this has been on the docket for 6 months and it's time to get rid of it and send a card to the plaintiff's lawyer. So that's, otherwise it would be, it's a separation of powers problem, I suppose. What comes to mind is sort of the fundamentally different thing. Beyond that, I don't know what kind of policy we should have, except that everybody is sort of accountable to the voters, to the taxpayers, to sort of keep things moving along and within a way that allows for justice to be done. And now this is getting sort of far afield of your question. I think that, generally speaking, some of these cases fall through the cracks. The problem with this one, and the mechanism to dismiss for want of a speedy trial is a way to sort of try to keep everybody on their toes. The problem with this one, I think, is that just the facts as we see them don't justify the dismissal. And that's why it is an odd case, and it is one that might be difficult to explain to the bench and bar. But in the end, our view is that that the trial judge essentially overreacted, and like you said, Justice Sutter, she fell on her sword and tried to take blame for what she saw as, again, a case falling through the cracks, even though it wasn't enormously long and it wasn't that terrible of a situation, but she did. And we think that she went beyond the facts and the record in justifying that decision. And that's why we pray for a remand.
I have a question. I will have to say that this was not like any motion to dismiss hearing I've ever seen or been involved in, because it really wasn't a hearing. But I think the case law says that both the state and the defense had an obligation to object to the judge not giving them an opportunity to try the issues that should have been tried in the hearing. And in a true hearing, the state has the burden to prove some things, and the defense has the burden to prove other things, such as prejudice. Neither one of y'all did that. So we've got what we've got, but my question is, in light of all that, in the brief, the appellee's brief in this case, he says he has no objection to sending this case back to the trial court to have a real hearing instead of just characterize it as a conversation, but a real hearing. What's the state's position on that?
We object to that. I don't see why she should get two bites at the apple. It was her, and I'll disagree about something else. It was her burden to justify the dismissal. We could just sit back, and if she's not going to prove prejudice, I'm not sure, we're not there to sort of like...
It's your burden to prove the reasons for the delay.
The
case law says it's your burden to prove the reasons
for the
delay.
But it's not our burden, Judge, to prove why she is not entitled to a dismissal. It's her burden to prove that, and I don't think that she even came close to meeting that burden, and that's after a balancing of the factors. But you're right, we did discuss in this conversation, as you call it, the reasons for the delay, which would go to, you know, whose fault it is. But the problem with essentially abating it for a fact-finding hearing is that, that abatement might be helpful to clarify something that actually happened in court. But here we don't have anything. We have nothing happened. It would be like, okay, if any time that a defendant failed to prove a prejudice in a motion to dismiss for want of a speedy trial, then does the appellate court send it back so that they get another chance to prove it? I think that they had their opportunity and they didn't do that. And that
would
be.
Do you have any authority for your position that it's inappropriate to send it back for a hearing?
On a particular case of a motion for speedy trial, no. We did cite a couple of cases in our brief, at least one, which remanded it or reversed a decision to dismiss for want of a speedy trial on the basis that the judge didn't hold an actual hearing on it, that it was lacking, that there wasn't, in other words, there wasn't enough to justify the dismissal because there wasn't a meaningful hearing. And that's one thing that we would rely on. But otherwise, it's...
So you're saying you have no burden whatsoever in the trial court?
No, the burdens shift, obviously. I mean, if he's got a burden or she has a burden to justify the dismissal, she's got to raise the evidence.
Well, isn't there a presumption with a 685-day delay? Doesn't the case law say that there is a presumption at that point, so you go forward and then it's your responsibility to prove the reasons for that delay?
Well, within that particular factor, but of course there's four factors, and she's going to have to prove, for example, prejudice. That's all on her.
I understand that. That's why I said it's her responsibility to prove that and yours to prove the reasons for the delay, and neither one of y'all did that.
Well, I'm not, well, exactly, because there wasn't exactly what I would call a true hearing. But I think maybe in the end, the prosecutors were caught flat-footed because I don't think anybody expected, especially with the conversation that the judge started the conversation with, which was, well, Lee, I don't think 2 years is, you know, that far out of the range for this kind of case. And then for her to turn around at the end and say, oh, I'm going to dismiss it, I think they were sort of stunned. But I can see how other cases one might want to see the state actually get up there and push the evidence a bit more. All I'm saying is that with regard to the final sort of merits of the case and proving the factors, that burden has got, or at least the burden of production has got to remain with the defendant she wants the action. And if, for example, she makes these arguments, and they're essentially just arguments to the judge, who then agrees, and that's why we're here now. And we disagree with the balancing because we just don't think that there were any actual facts on record that would justify the dismissal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Justice Gabriel, first a question you asked initially when Mr. Gibson started speaking. The record does not indicate that this hearing or that this motion to dismiss for speedy trial violation was set at that May 5th, I think it was, time. So I can't tell you that was clear at all because it's not in the record. The challenge here is that I think the state and the defense agree on about only one thing here, and that is that regrettably we have to look to the trial court for much of the issues and challenges that we had here. The reality is that Ms. Bryan has wanted a motion to suppress hearing from virtually the get-go. 6 days after entering an appearance in this case, Steve Swander filed the motion to suppress. And you can see in the clerk's record that at the first setting of the case, his action was to set the motion for hearing. And it was set in, I believe it was November 1st of 2012, it was set. Unfortunately, he took sick, and unfortunately it turned out to be far more serious than initially thought, and it had to be bumped off the docket because of his illness. And then, of course, he passed, and that's when I came on board and took the case over. But my first appearance was in January 7th, and the very first thing that I did was request a hearing on the motion to suppress. So we've been trying to get it there for a long time. In fact, when I requested in January that motion to suppress hearing, the next time the court had available to hear it was in April, some 3 months later. Now, I'm sure the trial courts have very congested dockets, but that's consistent with what we saw on later settings as well, needing 2+ months to set something for at most a 30-minute hearing. And so we have been trying to prosecute this from the beginning, and Ms. Bryan has never wavered from her desire to have this motion to suppress heard. And we've got to get through that before we can even then begin to deal with the actual trial or motion to quash or other things that may flow from how the motion to suppress is ruled on.
Are you saying that you requested the hearing that was set in April of 2013?
Yes, ma'am.
And so why was there a concern that you didn't have notice of it, if you're the one who requested it?
I quite frankly don't understand that, Your Honor, because when I arrived, the hearing had been canceled, and I was informed that it was because they were concerned that I did not have notice. We had a similar problem in January when I arrived for that setting, though you can see in the clerk's record I filed the county notice of appearance form, I think 2 or 3 weeks ahead of that. I arrived to find Ms. Bryan in the jury box as if she had no counsel, and was told at that time that she was there because they were unsure if I was going to show up or not.
Was that in January 13 of 13 or January of 14?
That was January of 13.
Okay.
I believe it was January 7th of 2013.
Is any of that actually in the record, though, that we are reviewing? Because there's so much that's contained in the briefs that really isn't reflected in the record.
And that may be ultimately why this court should send this back for a full-blown hearing under 38.2B. The references that I make are all to the motion and supplemental motion that I filed. Now, there are certainly exhibits, though, to those that are clear and unequivocal. You know, we attach a copy of the email from the court coordinator. There's a copy of the voicemail that the court coordinator left about an hour and 15 minutes before we were going to have the hearing.
Of course, none of that's really evidence from a hearing. It's just a pleading. It's just something that was attached to a pleading, correct?
Yes, ma'am. And so it would really be more akin to summary judgment type evidence than anything introduced at a formal hearing on this. So.
And those delays in April and January, don't let me put words in your mouth, but it doesn't sound like you're attributing those delays to the state. You're attributing them to the trial court.
Unfortunately, I think that the state and I are in agreement that the first cause of this problem was in the trial court there, and how all manner of things were handled or not handled there. I think that the state and I disagree as to the second cause, but yes, ma'am, it's unfortunately something where we're looking at the trial court saying, you know, why are we not there yet? As far as the prejudice prong goes, no, we can't say that we've had a loss of witnesses or incarceration or anything like that. But we've got to remember, these cases are misdemeanors. And because they occurred at the same time, the punishment would be concurrent. So by the time we get to the point where the trial court grants that motion to dismiss for speedy trial violation, we're now basically 2 weeks shy of the statute of limitations for the offenses and the maximum term of probation that she could be required to serve on those cases.
Are there conditions of bond?
No, ma'am. And then, Justice Snopeno, you had asked about the point in the motion on that. I did reference in the original motion to dismiss that the time that these cases had been lingering when I filed the original motion, not the supplemental one, was 21 months, which was three-quarters of a year beyond the maximum term of confinement for these offenses. Certainly, if we were talking about a capital murder, we wouldn't be here today talking about this. But this is a situation where we can't get a brief hearing on a motion to suppress for 2 years. And it's something where we have consistently and persistently sought this relief. It's not something where this pops up at the eve of trial. We're filing a motion because we found something.
The factors that we look at say we don't look at you've consistently tried to get your hearing set. It's whether you have asserted your right to a speedy trial. And the only time that your client actually asserted her right to a speedy trial was in a motion to dismiss, which was filed 601 days after the charging instrument. So if we're going to weigh these factors, how does that weigh?
Well, and honestly, Your Honor, I'm not even asking for a trial right now, because we have to resolve this motion to suppress question before we can move forward. So,
but you say that we should remand this under 38.2B, but under 38.2B, the only way that we remand something for a hearing is if we reverse and remand, or if the appellee raised a cross point that requires the taking of additional evidence. Neither one of those really apply in this case, do they?
Well, I think the state has clearly said that the record is not sufficiently well developed here. I mean, I honestly read their brief as saying we cannot decide on this record. I mean, that's
asking that question, and he said he objected to this court sending it back for an evidentiary hearing on the motion to dismiss. So apparently, if that's what was written, they've changed their mind.
Well, when I look at the state's brief here, their point of error begins on page 6. There's a two-sentence introduction, and then the lack of any meaningful hearing by itself should lead to a reversal of the trial court's decision to dismiss. And then they cite some authority there about how you don't have you can't evaluate it unless you have a full record. And only after that do they move to Roman numeral point 2, the substantive law and standard of review, and begin the analysis of what it looks like under the Barker v. Wingo 4 factors with what we've got in the record now. So,
yes, effectively, if this court were to just reverse the case and remand it back anew, you'd just file another motion to dismiss, and then you could have a hearing.
Well, I honestly hadn't thought that far forward, but I suppose that is a possibility. And if we don't have that, maybe then we get to the motion to suppress. Or if that's denied, then we would move on, hopefully at that point, to the motion to suppress. Although I think that raises an interesting point of whether Barker v. Wingo and this constitutional provision apply only to a true jury trial, or whether they apply to preliminary proceedings here. Because we have certainly sought settings consistently on this motion to suppress, and have never wavered from a desire to have that motion.
So So the question in your mind is, what right does a defendant have to assert? Is it the right for a final trial or the right to proceed with the prosecution by hearing the motions, issuing subpoenas? Suppose the hang-up were the defense couldn't get any subpoenas issued. Would the attempt, the repeated attempt to get subpoenas issued, satisfy the requirements of attempting to get into the courthouse? What all would satisfy, or is it only the request for a trial? Even though none of your motions has been heard, you can't get subpoenas. I mean, do you have to push for a trial if you can't get subpoenas? Do you have to push for a trial if your motion to quash the indictment hadn't been heard? Are you waiving your motion to quash, waiving your motion to suppress if you push for a trial without hearing? Or is that what we're talking about?
Exactly. And I hadn't really thought that all the way through until listening to Mr. Gibson's arguments to the court, because as I was hearing and interpreting what he's saying, I took it to mean that because we had not said we need a jury trial now, we were entitled to no relief and had no rights. I haven't researched it, but I sure can't think that that's what the Constitution has in mind there when we're persistently trying to get some relief, or at least get some action there.
Do you agree that the defendant has the burden to prove prejudice in a real hearing on a motion to dismiss?
Yes, ma'am. I believe that is the case.
And in this hearing, what took place on that day, that didn't happen, did it?
No, I think it's fair to characterize it as a conversation more than anything discussing the procedural history of the case, although, quite frankly, the procedural history of the case is a big piece of the argument and the issue there. So, Justice Gabriel, you had asked about the speedy trial waiver in the reset form. That is kind of a potential problem and issue there. That's a standard form seen in most, if not all, of the county criminal courts here in Tarrant County. That's obviously a little one or two sentence blurb that appears in that form. It's certainly not anything of the magnitude of any kind of plea document that has considerably more admonishments and warnings in it. And it's certainly not all the way to the level of a, say, full-blown Faretta hearing to evaluate whether somebody really wants to proceed pro se and represent themselves. So it's in there, but it's much more akin to a form than anything, and it's not even something that the record reflects was heard or discussed with the defendant by the trial judge. And of course the ramifications of that are anytime you or anybody wants a reset on that form, then that would just open the door to exactly what we've got here. Potentially years of delay on a misdemeanor for which there is now no remedy at all. So I think the ramifications of that carried all the way out probably are pretty dire from the standpoint of how it was situated. And one final note there, the clerk's record does reflect on one of those two forms where that language appears, that the reason for the continuance was checked the other box and the coordinator had written in state. So that really raises an interesting question there from the standpoint of if the motion is sought based on a need of the state, how does that defense waiver of those rights factor in? I think I'm over time now, so I'd better.
Okay. Thanks, Lee.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Gibson, any rebuttal?
I went way over my time. If I could have a couple of minutes, I'd appreciate it.
Well, we ask a bunch of questions. We ask Lee a bunch of questions.
Well, I appreciate it. First of all, let me, I don't know, Justice Gabriel, if you were being facetious about sending it back for another motion or a motion to dismiss for want of a speedy trial. I think, and I don't want to get way above my head here, but it seems to me that it would be a res judicata or issue preclusion problem, or otherwise we would have every time the state won one of these appeals where a trial judge improperly dismissed for want of a speedy trial, it would never end. We just send it back and send it back at some point, and that's why we think that, and that's why we're saying, and this dovetails into my other point, it was, I never made the argument, and I certainly don't today, that it would be appropriate to remand this or abate it, which would be the proper term, to hold yet another hearing on this thing. That hearing, if you want to call it that, and I'll use finger quotes, the hearing occurred, and for better or worse, it happened. If certain things did not come into evidence, then that's how it is, and that's why we're complaining that whatever happened during that conversation was not enough to justify the dismissal. And so that's why we think this can end now, and that this court can decide the case on the merits without remanding it for further fact-finding, just because the facts, if you want to call it that, that came out were a little bit peculiarly done, for lack of a better term. That doesn't give the defendant a chance now to go back and relitigate everything. And so,
well, again, okay, after 2 years, the reason y'all were all in court in the first place was to try to get a hearing on the motion to suppress that had been pending for about 2 years.
Right.
And had been set at their request several times.
Yes.
So tell me what you think of the answer to my question is. Is it only the request for a trial on the merits, or is it the setting of the motions that you can't get heard that you look at?
I have zero authority for what I'm about to say.
That's
but
okay.
If I've said trial, you know, she didn't seem to want a trial. If I'm speaking that way, I meant that as shorthand for just
sure.
The procedural niceties that go into the whole trial on the merits. What if that includes pretrial motions, such as a motion to suppress? I mean, I'm completely happy to remand this so that they can finally have this motion to suppress. She has a right to have this motion to suppress heard, and I have no problem with that. My only problem is dismissing it for want of a speedy trial. And I suppose that's my answer to that.
You have any problem granting the motion to suppress?
And then we'll be back here again, I guess.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure you weren't giving us an out with a waiver here.
Oh, no, no, no. No, no.
Okay. Any other
Thank
questions?
You. Oh.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Well, we appreciate your being here to argue. And as you can tell, we had lots of questions. So your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business. If